Hello there, this is Colin Baker and you are listening to the 20 Megabyte Doctor Who podcast. And doesn't make... I'll do it again.
Go on.
Paid feed services in association with Who1.co.uk presents the 20 Megabyte Doctor Who podcast.
Hello and welcome to the 20 Megabyte Doctor Who podcast number 195. I'm Adam.
I'm Isabella.
And today we'll be talking about the DW celebration at the London XL. Yeah. And what we're going to do is we're going to basically talk about our day. And Isabella's here to jog my memory just in case I forget anything. So how did the day start yesterday then?
So we were packing to get ready to go on the boat for London and then...
Isabella, that was the day before yesterday we packed, wasn't it? Because we drove up on Friday, didn't we?
Then I've got it wrong.
My God. Yeah, we drove up on the Friday night, didn't we? And we went to a Travelodge, which was on the M25.
Now you're remembering it.
In, where was it now? Where was it? Thurrock, wasn't it? Thurrock, that's very nice, wasn't it? That Travelodge.
Yeah.
Very large room. We should have stayed there for two nights. But we didn't know at the time we booked it we were going to do Harry Potter. But anyway, so we stayed there, and it was deliciously lovely, wasn't it? Were you sick on that occasion?
Well,
no.
You were sick on the journey up, weren't you?
Yeah.
But anyway, because Isabella's been ill, haven't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So don't lie down. So then, could you sit up, please? Can you sit up next to me, please? Sit here. I can't lean over like that. So we got up on that morning and made our very early way. What time did we leave? I can't remember now. It was about seven, wasn't it? About seven-ish. About 7:15. So as we could get there nice and early. It wasn't a very long drive into London, wasn't it? Got a bit confused with the sat-nav as we got to the XL. Parked in the orange car park when we were advised to park in the purple one.
No, the man said that we can park anywhere.
He did, yes. And it just so happens the orange car park was actually nearer to the entrance anyway. And then we went into the big hall where everybody was queuing. And fortunately, because we'd made the decision to make an early trip, the queue wasn't too bad, was it?
No, it wasn't actually.
So, yes, and it was quite warm, so I had to go back to the car and take the coats back. Can you lean and sit over here? Thank you. That's right, sit with your legs around the other way. Thank you. Yeah, so I had to take the coats and stuff back to the car, which was a good move, wasn't it, Deb?
Oh, God, yeah.
So eventually, 8 o'clock, I think it was, they let us through the main sort of gates into a massive, great big hall. And there we waited for about an hour. It was supposed to open at 9, but they kept on saying the doors will be opening in 5 minutes, or they'll say 10 minutes. And that 5 and 10 minutes turned into half an hour. But eventually, at 9:30, the doors open, and then what happened?
The people, everyone got in.
Yeah, we went into the where did we go first though?
We went into the big arena, theatre thing, and got they were so desperate to get everybody in quickly, we ended up sitting in the TARDIS Ice Warrior seats, sort of nearly front row to watch the special effects show, didn't we? What happened in the special effects show?
So, there was this man which, there's the things and
explosions.
Yeah.
So what blew up then?
So the blew up was the Dalek. The Dalek blew up.
Yeah.
And he wanted this boy and this girl and
what on the stage though?
Boy and a girl. Oh, the Cyberman. The Cyberman came on the stage. And then the man called up a boy and a girl. And
well, the girl was more of a woman, really, wasn't she? What was she dressed as?
She was dressed as a TARDIS.
What was the boy dressed as?
One of the doctors.
I can't remember which one, though. Never mind.
I think his name was Lucas.
I think he was dressed up as Matt Smith.
Was it Matt Smith, was it? So what happened then?
So, like, the man held the little boy and tried to use the gun and...
Oh, yeah, so what they blew up, they shot the Cyberman?
Yes. Yeah. But he came back alive.
Ah, I see.
And, then they get put them off the stage and, I like the part when he said that, let's pull the Cyberman's pants down.
You like that part, did you?
Yeah.
Okay. So we decided to leave that early, didn't we? Because we wanted to get queuing for what?
Doctor Who.
No, we wanted to go up and make sure we got in the queue for the Jenna Coleman photograph, didn't we? And that was another good idea of mine, wasn't it?
No.
Yes, it was. So we went up there and you decided. What did you decide once we got in the queue for the Jenna Coleman photo? What did you decide?
To sit down.
No, you decided you wanted to go to the toilet when we were queuing for that. Fortunately, at the XL, there are toilets everywhere, which is one of the really good things about it. Anyway, but so you came back and we got in there and what happened when we...
Quite quickly, that queue.
It was a quick queue, only because we were in there quite early. Yeah. What did Jenna say to you? Do you remember?
Hi.
She said hi, but said spoke. She didn't speak to me or your mum, she said hi to you. She looked at you and said, hi, didn't she? So we had a picture. I put my hand around her waist, didn't I? And mum stood on the other side.
I standing in the middle.
Yes. Sorry, I'm just remembering. I put my hand around her waist. Anyway, so she was very nice, didn't speak to her very long. But can you come back here?
Yeah.
So what do we do after the Jenna photo? We headed off down into the main sort of
autograph.
Yeah, the main arena area where all the shops and there, which was very packed. But you go, and the good thing about this was that you went through a little entrance which was made up to look like Totter's Lane. Isabella,
stop it.
It was made to look like Totter's Lane, wasn't it? And there was a little TARDIS in there, wasn't there? Everybody was having their picture taken with that. And then there was great big queues for the autographs. But they didn't take too long going through, did they, the queues? It looked like you were going to be there for hours, but fortunately the queues did go down quite quickly. I forgot about mentioning Henry, didn't we? Henry Mendoza, who sold me his Colin Baker autograph opportunity, the reason being his mum bought him one and he bought him one, so he ended up with two. So he sold me his for 15 quid with a letter of consent, which they accepted, I was glad to say. So we went in there and we saw, who do we see first? I think it was Nicola Bryant. In that particular thing. And I was, her cleavage was particularly prominent, as it always is. It has to be Nicola Bryant. Her cleavage has to be on show, doesn't it? Well, you wouldn't know that, but it is law that she will have a low-cut top. She was very nice. Did she speak to you?
Yeah.
Does she? Do you remember what she said?
She liked my hairband.
What, Nicola Bryant? You know who I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. She liked Isabella's hairband. And we had a picture taken with her, and she signed the 20 megabyte. Poster.
Yes, I know.
And then who did we see after that?
This
is where my memory is starting to struggle
I
now. Louise Jameson, I believe.
Yeah.
Or did
she
we?
She remembers.
Yes, she obviously remembered being on the show, and remembered seeing pictures of Isabella posted somewhere. Do you remember what Louise Jameson said to you?
She likes my hairband as well.
She likes her hairband as
and
well.
I thought I was cute.
Okay. And she was lovely. She is lovely anyway, Louise. And I've got a sneeze coming. Can you come back up, please? The only frustrating thing is that we were quite near all these other people, like Fraser Hines, Jeffrey Beavers didn't have really queuing at him, unfortunately, and Deborah Watling, but we couldn't go anywhere near speaking to them. Of course, I've got some nice pictures of Sophie Aldred, but again, couldn't really speak to her. So that's the only frustrating thing for that, the fact that everybody was there together with their autograph queues. So if I'd booked autograph with all of them, which would have cost a fortune.
We met Daphne Ashbrook.
Yeah, that was on the next time we went round. Because she is pretty. After we went round the that first autograph thing, we went somewhere else, didn't we? And that's where we met, I bumped into John Colshaw, who was looking at the Bessie thing, and he was talking to me in a John Pertwee voice. I wish I'd recorded that, but I was caught on the hop a little bit. But he was really nice. I had a picture taken with him. Then we went and saw a bit of Graham Norton's radio show. And then at the back of the auditorium was Mazimba from, I think it's Mazimba. I can never remember how to pronounce his name, who does the BBC News reports, used to be on Newsround, black guy with the glasses. He very kindly gave us an interview. And here I am at the Doctor Who celebration. If you'd like to introduce yourself, sir.
I'm Lizo Mazimba. I'm the entertainment correspondent for BBC News, here covering it for the BBC.
So have you been here all weekend?
No, just today, actually, as today's the actual birthday, but people seem to be having a very good time.
Are you having a good time?
Yes, I'm getting to interview lots of people. I interviewed Matt and Jenna earlier. I interviewed Stephen Moffat. I'll be interviewing Tom Baker later on. So it's one of those wonderful things where it's my job, but I would do it if it were free, because, you know, I love it so much, and as somebody who does enjoy Doctor Who, it's great being able to meet some of those people who I do enjoy watching on television, and it's a wonderful way for me to celebrate Doctor Who's 50th birthday.
So you're rather lucky then, really, aren't you?
I'm incredibly lucky that people are paying me to kind of like, what, go and interview Peter Davison? Oh, okay, I'll just do it just this once, only that you're paying me, mind. So yeah, you know, hand on heart, you know, touch wood, very, very lucky. I always say that I think I've got the best job in the world, and today's like this prove it.
Absolutely. Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you.
And that was the first interview I did with him, and he was brilliant. So after that, we went back to the queues for the autographs, where we met Daphne, and it was lovely walking around the corner and seeing her there. Took a picture of her, queued up there, and I went immediately up to her, got the mug out, and then she realised who I was when she saw the mug. And also the fact that I plonked a microphone down in front of her.
What?
If I stick that in front of you, it might give you a clue.
Oh, okay.
I've got something else for you here.
Is this for me to sing into?
That's for you too.
Oh, my God. I know who you are. How are you?
I'm all right. It's lovely to meet you.
Great to meet you. I had fun. This was fun.
Yeah, shall we do it again sometime, won't we?
Yeah. Absolutely. Who's this beautiful young child?
Isabella. She's a bit miserable today.
Isabella. You're a bit miserable?
Yeah.
Miserable as in, oh, dad, I'm going to punch you miserable, or...
Chatting.
You're a little cutie.
Thank you. It's
my
nice
goodness
say
sakes.
So.
Oh, look. Oh, okay.
It's to Adam. I'm going to fit it on there somewhere.
You said to Matt.
No, to Adam.
Okay. I thought you said Matt for a minute there.
No.
My hearing is really bad.
So is mine. Don't worry about it.
Woo! This ear went belly up in January. Last January.
Really?
Yeah.
What?
Overnight.
Is that because you were on our show and it just...
That must have been it.
Yeah.
I'm going to blame you from now on. It's your fault. All right. She's all, yeah, blame him.
Enjoy the mug. Do you want a box for it? I've got a box for it.
Huh?
I've got a box for the mug if you want to keep it in a mug. In a box, I should say.
In a box. Oh, for the cup? Yeah, that wouldn't be a bad idea.
I'll give you a box. There you go. Vista Print's finest.
Thank you.
Travel box. Can I have a picture?
Sure, of course. Thank you. This is brilliant.
I won't. With the mug. Oh yeah. Can we have a picture with the mug? Would that be right?
Oh sure. Of course.
Yeah. It's no advertiser or anything. It's just to prove
no,
I give it to
brilliant.
You. Really.
Yay! Yay! Awesome! Yay!
Thank you, Daphne.
Great to see you, sweetie. Thank you.
Speak to you soon.
You're a little doll. Oh my goodness.
What about her?
I'll
though?
Take you home with me.
that was lovely though, wasn't it?
Uh-huh.
You didn't know who she was, but what did Daphne say to you?
He said that I was cute and wanted to take me home.
And Deb said she could. Sorry, your mum said that's fine, but you see, still seem to be with us, so I might have to tweet to Daphne that she forgot to take you with her. Yes, and then after that we saw Old Sixie himself, who was very kind enough to. Do a rather brilliant sting for the show.
Hello, I'm Colin Baker. You lucky people are listening to the 20 megabyte Doctor Who podcast, the best podcast on the pod.
Absolutely. Thank you, Colin. All right. Yes. So what do we do after the autographs? You're winding me up now. Can you sit up, please? What do we do after the autographs? Yeah, shrug your shoulders and go all sulky. I think... We had to go to the next two shows, didn't we, after that? In all this, we didn't really get much time to eat anything, did we? Other than what we had in the bags. Because it was all a bit rushed and queuing and stuff like that. So what was the next show we saw? We saw the Regenerations show, which had Tom Baker on great form, Peter Davison, Sylvester McCoy, and who was the other one, Deb?
Colin Baker.
That's the one. You're not Deb, are you? Yeah, so that was about an hour and a half of a talk with that lot, and that was really, really good.
Delighted, as was my bank manager when they heard it was coming back. So we're two happy people at least. I believed from the very beginning of my end, when I killed it off, that it would come back. I knew it would. I believed it. I thought, these people are mad. This program is such a loved program. It might not be loved by the whole majority of the people, but a very large, active minority loved Doctor Who when I was doing it, and I knew that. And, you know, for them to kill it was ridiculous. And so when it came back, I was delighted and, you know, I felt vindicated. And I'm so pleased it's there. My bank manager's delighted as well.
Tom, did you think that Doctor Who would ever come back?
Did I think it would ever come back?
Yes.
Well, I didn't know it had gone away, actually. Because, quite naturally, I didn't watch Doctor Who when I was in it. I didn't want to watch it, I wanted to play it. And when I got the job, I was reborn from being a kind of just a run-of-the-mill lapsed Catholic. And I was reborn, and life suddenly became more interesting as Doctor Who. And remained like that, so I've stayed with it. I'm still Doctor Who on audio tapes, on audio discs, and I still love all that thing. Now, the other day I had to go to Buckingham Palace. and so, you know, I suppose I thought I'd give it a go. And to get in, you had to have an electricity bill. And a few other things, and no guns were allowed. And when I got to the palace gate, the head of security was there, and I had my envelope full of all this tedious documentation. And he stuck his head in the car. He said, "Hello, Tom, I saw you in Waitrose the other day in Tenterden. Just waved me through." I waved back to him, yeah. That was because I was his Doctor Who, really. So I'm all in favour of it all, yeah. The nicest thing that ever happened to me. Yeah. Mm. Ask me another question.
So that was me just shaking my head because I couldn't hear what they were saying to me in my earphone. It's fair to say then that Doctor Who changed your life?
Yeah, it did. Well, I mean, I hope the others would agree, it changed their lives. I don't know to what extent, they have to tell you that. But yes, it did change my life, where I was suddenly allowed myself to become I was a fiction, of course, but I was actually a walking fiction. And everything I did had to be done in the style of Doctor Who, such as my style was. And I was very careful, would never scandalize children with cigarettes or swearing, any of that thing. I wanted to live this kind of part. And it was so much better than being Tom Baker, you know, who was often rather anxious and sometimes unhappy. But when I was the Doctor, which was most of the time, and that's why I got through the days being the Doctor everywhere I went. You know, I could walk in, I could knock on any door if there was a sign of a family there. And the door would open and they'd say, "Come in, come on in." Yeah. And now, when I go to the hospice, no, I'm being very serious now, you'll like this. And I had to go round. I'm a great supporter of my local hospice, and I had to go round and see the people because the man accidentally said to me, "Tom, they're dying to meet you." Terrible slipping of tongue, but there you are. Anyway, so I went up there and I saw these sad people. Everyone dies in the hospice. And one old lady was so thrilled to see me that she thought she'd died and gone to heaven and that I was the greeter. She said, held her arms out like that and said, "Fancy seeing you here." Kissed my hand. She said, "Is Gabriel about?" I didn't realize you'd get that joke.
Yeah. Peter, how did it change your life being the Doctor?
Well, I was the first Doctor, I think, that grew up watching Doctor Who. So it was very strange of being actually offered the part, just by being offered your part of your childhood hero. As an actor, I'd often thought about being in the series, but never dreamt that I would actually end up playing the part. How much has changed my life? Of course, you don't know, because we've lived with it now since we did it. So I don't think it particularly catapulted me anywhere, But it certainly didn't hinder me, and I've always been very, very happy to maintain, ever since the day I left, really, maintain my association with Doctor Who, because I love it as a series. So yes, it has changed my life. Of course, we get invited to wonderful places, and we spend weekends with people telling us how wonderful we are, because that's really not hard work, is it? But going back to what Polly was saying, what keeps our feet on the ground is our children, largely. So you'll be at home and you'll appear on the TV in something, and you'll bring your kids in and go, look at it on the TV, and they'll just look at it and go, you. Comment, how's it changed your life?
That reminds me of the night when I recorded my first ever scene with Peter, and I was the Doctor, and I was feeling pretty damn good about that. And I went home, and my wife was sitting reading a book quietly in the corner, and I came in, and I stood in the doorway, and I said, I am the Doctor. And there was only the briefest of pauses before she said, that's nice, dear, could you put the rubbish out? So it probably hasn't changed my life in a slightest. Life goes on, thank goodness. It meant that I had, for 3 years, I shared with these lovely people around me that having the best job on television, which it undoubtedly is, it's the best job on television. And for 3 years, I had a crack at it, and I loved every second of it. So it's changed my life because it made me happy.
Are you all right, Doctor?
Yeah, if I sit down here, I'm so small, one of this is your back.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So I can start sitting up and see you all because you're so interesting.
Are you comfortable then?
Anyway, yes. No, I am comfortable.
Okay. Oh, they're just concerned about you.
Yes.
What,
I'm not spoiling your shots, am I?
I don't think they're trying to shoot you.
Oh. Well, you know, I was in America when I got Doctor Who, and very first time I was in this place, and 1,000 people out there, and a guy got up and said to me, "That Mr. McCoy, now you've become so universally famous, are you worried about being shot?" I was standing, well, they shot John Lennon, oh my God. So I hid behind the couch. And they didn't shoot me. So you never know. I thought Colin Baker's fans will come up and try and kill me, but they didn't. They couldn't shoot straight.
They were in mourning.
Yes.
All right, well, let's go back to the beginning of Doctor Who. I don't know whether any of you have ever seen the first episode. I mean, I know, Peter, you said you watched it at the time. Well, you watched it at the time.
I saw it at the time.
Well, let's have a little. It was on BBC4 earlier this week. Let's have a little look at it now.
You imagine you heard her voice? You believe she might be in there? It's not very substantial, is it?
But why won't you help us?
I'm not hindering you.
Yeah. What's your reaction, guys, watching that?
That's just a fantastic moment, though, isn't it? Yeah. I remember that moment where they rushed through the door, and it's bigger on the inside. It's fantastic.
It seems like we know all about it now, don't we? So it's mm. So, Tom, do you recognise that as something you're part of? Does it look?
No. The bits I watched when Doctor Who was where Patrick Troughton was there. And I was very impressed by Troughton's intensity. He had a dark, saturnine quality. And had done a great, at that time, I think it's, I know him from playing Peter Quill in the old Curiosity Shop, which he played with terrifying intensity. And yet then when I met him, he was a very sweet man, very considerate, a darling companion. And so years later, when it cropped up, that's all I knew about Doctor Who was the lovely, dark quality of, and yet still lovable, but dark. And you get the impression from Troughton that he wasn't telling you the whole story, you know? I think that's a sign of very, very good acting, when you don't get the whole picture, that there's something in reserve. In other words, that there's a secret somewhere, and you're in part of it. But there's more to come. And I think he did that very well, too. Mm.
Well, I know he's your favourite Doctor, isn't he?
Patrick, well, he did the job that enabled the rest of us to do ours. If that first regeneration had not been as superb as it was, because he was so different from William Hart, and it was wonderfully beguilingly kind of at right angles to everything else that was going on, and somehow he managed always
sort things out without you noticing that he'd done it. Which is kind of, he was like a wild magician. Wonderful. And I knew him well, because I'd shared a flat with David in some years. In fact, I was David's best man when he got married. So I knew Pat in those days. And he was such a generous man. Because when I did Two Doctors with him, there was a reticence on my part, because I thought, this is Patrick Troughton, the Second Doctor. And I wanted to know, I respected him, but it was mutual, which was lovely.
Brilliant.
Very generous.
Sylvester, going back to that clip there about William Hartnell, what are your feelings about him as the Doctor and seeing a clip like that, whether it related to anything that you were part of?
Well, I mean, sadly it reminds me of the Kennedy getting shot, really. Because it's all happened at the same time, and it's all kind of mixed up in my, kind of hippie teenage years when it first came out. I didn't really see much William Hartnell, because I didn't have a television. It was only when Patrick arrived, I got hooked on it, because a friend of mine had a television and we used to go and watch it. And so, in a way, Patrick is my Doctor, the first one who attracted me to Doctor Who. And when I got the job of Doctor Who, I hadn't seen it for years. I'd seen it up to Tom's, the first half of Tom's tenure. Then I became an actor and we didn't have any VCRs and all that kind of stuff, so I lost touch with it. But I had this distant memory, and Patrick and Tom, and when I arrived, I just kind of thought of them and brought up my own Doctor.
Tom, we're going to have a look at you now in a clip. Here we go.
Davros, if you had created a virus in your laboratory, something contagious and infectious that killed on contact, a virus that would destroy all other forms of life.
I would do it. That power would set me up above the gods. And through the Daleks, I shall have that power.
Michael Bishop or Henry?
Because Henry Wolfe did that part later, I think. I didn't know when that was. Michael Wisher.
It was Michael Wisher.
Oh,
yes.
He absolutely adored that part, And he took it so seriously that in the rehearsal room, he used to put a paper bag over his, a shopping bag over his head, came down to there, and he could put his fag in, and he made two holes in the top of it, of the bag, and he puffed away, caps in full space, I think two at a time. And out came the smoke to the top of his head, through the top of his shopping bag, and we crept out, being cruel actors, we crept out one day, because he actually lived the part, and we crept out for lunch, leaving him there, with cigarette smoke. Yeah, we took great pleasure in that.
Something I always find interesting when I watch episodes from your first series, which that was Genesis of the Daleks in that first season, is that, of course, while you were doing that, while you were filming all that, as far as the public were concerned, John Pertwee was Doctor Who, so you had no idea what they were going to think of you. And what was it like, that whole thing about taking over from John Pertwee? Did you have any worries that the audience might be screaming for him to come back?
That links actually to how I got it, because someone I played in a short play, The Millionaires, for Bill Slater, and when they were trying to cast Doctor Who, Bill Slater, because he was going to take over the department in 2 weeks' time, was invited by the then producer, Barry Letts, and they had an idea for a comedian called William Herndl. They said to Bill Slater, Have you got any ideas, Bill? And he said, no, I haven't got any ideas. Don't take over next week. And that night, when he got home, the last letter that he read was from me, saying, isn't there something down there that I could do? And he didn't say it. He didn't contact me then. He went back the next day, while they were still mulling over this thing, and they said, Bill, any ideas? And he said, yeah, what about Tom Baker? And they said, well, we've never heard of him. And he said, he's in a film next door called The Golden Voyage of Sinbad. And so it's right next door to the BBC, 20 yards away. And so they all piled into a taxi cab, no, two taxi cabs, and went along. And they saw me playing a wizard, and I was on. Bill rang me up and said, come see me. and then my heart began to, anyway, to make it, a long story short. I got the part, and as I got the part, Barry Lett said to me, there's just one thing, Tom, but. There's always a chilling but, isn't there, when you've got good news. I said, but what? He said, could you sit on it? Don't tell anybody for 2 weeks. I said, Christ, 2 weeks? All right, I said, okay. So I went back to, I was working on the building site then, making tea and things like that, and also doing the entertainment at lunchtime. And I went back to the pub, the Fox and Hounds in Bourne Street, for my pints. And there were two guys there who worked on British Radio who knew me, and they knew I was an actor. Everyone called me Sir Lawrence, you know, teasing. So one of them said, hello, Tom, got a job, have you? I said, no, I haven't. Oh, he said, I'd say you've got a job. He actually sensed a difference in me, and I so wanted to tell him, you know? I so wanted to tell him, but I couldn't, in case they withdrew the job. I don't know whether... Could you get in on this act?
I think it was Richard Hearn.
It was Richard Hearn, Mr. Pastry.
Mr. Pastry, now
yeah. It was Mr. Pastry they were thinking of. Second thoughts, because Richard was a comedian, a children's comedian, and he thought he'd like to play it in the style of a guy called Mr. Pastry.
Yep.
And then that set the alarm bells ringing. Plus the fact that he was 111.
So, Peter, let's have a look at you. Right, Doctor. So for anyone who hasn't seen it.
Doctor the Mouse.
Doctor Who had a very different look about it in those days, like the TARDIS. Very different inside from the way it is now.
Really? Yes.
In those days, yes.
Yeah,
well, of course, in those days, during all the classic Doctors, it was a TARDIS that was just built for the studio, so it was wheeled in and out. So it really had to sort of look like that way. And now, when it was done in Ian Cardiff, when it came back, it was what they call a standing set, so they were able to add all these wonderfully intricate things to it and make it on a different level. But we were very much just stuck on that studio floor with that extraordinary overlit set. So I was actually, when I did go down to Cardiff and do something on that set, I was a bit envious, actually, because it looked pretty good to me.
Didn't shake.
No, it didn't shake.
That new TARDIS set, particularly the one they have now, is quite amazing.
Yes.
It sort of looks like Noah's Ark from outside.
It does. It's like a complete pod, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just a Cadbury, really.
An American audience said to me once, Mr. Baker, they take it very seriously in America. They saw me as some kind of messianic figure, because every now and then I would lay hands on some person and they'd say, dear God, I can walk. But it was just hysteria. But I used to... They said, Mr. Baker, you're such an interesting actor. I mean, I've never actually seen anybody walk into a room the way you do. As a matter of fact, a famous director called John Dexter said, Baker, you are so boring, you can't even walk into a room sincerely. What happened was, in the Doctor Who thing, I used to come creeping in, as if I was on a landmine or something. And they said it was wonderful acting and so intense. What they didn't realise is if I'd come in naturalistically, everything shook. And we would have to do the shot again. And I used to argue sometimes with the directors. I said, listen, what you guys haven't read, I've researched it. On Gallifrey, they've got the kind of architecture where everything shakes if anybody coughs. And so it's just part of the course. But the BBC, they were literally...
Colin, it's time for your clip. Let's have a look.
Oh, is it?
My word, that's a mess. Take you quite a while to put that back together again.
That will not be necessary.
Yes, you talked about working with Patrick Troughton earlier. What about Fraser Hine?
What about him?
Yes.
What about Fraser Hine?
What about him, eh?
Wee Scottish Jimmy. Male companion can clearly work.
Yes.
It worked for Patrick. I've never had a male companion. I'm delighted to say. No, he's lovely.
Now, I'm reliably informed that at the time you were shooting that, Peter Davison was shooting something called L Driver, I'm told it was called.
What a success story that was. L Driver.
It was
to teach people whose first language was not English, who immigrated here, and it was explained very, very clearly what this sign means here. And it was rather embarrassing, actually, because I tend to talk quite quickly. And the whole point of the show was I had to speak very, very slowly. We took quite a long time to do, so I nipped out one day when Colin was in the studio shooting that, just to say hello, really.
And you arrived on the set of Doctor Who.
I arrived on the set of Doctor Who, and Colin said,
"Back so soon?"
I thought, I remember him saying back too soon, but maybe not.
I have to say, this is a story that neither of them actually remember if we told them to say.
Yes, that's right. But I will take the opportunity to tell you a shaking set story.
Oh, yes.
There was, in one of my stories, I had a long shot running down a corridor, lots of explosions. At the end of it, I had to bang a button on the wall and go through a door. And it was all one long tracking shot. And they set it all up, and it all worked perfectly until the moment when I banged the button, because I realised that the set had come apart. So I was holding the wall up, so I froze for a while, and the switch went on upstairs. "For God's sake, get yourself through the door, you're ruining the shot." I said, "I can't." "Will you do it?" So I did it, and the set fell down.
They should have listened. Sylvester, here's a clip of you.
All right.
Having a scrap with Anthony Ainley.
Oh. If we fight like animals, we'll die!
There you are, Anthony Ainley as the master. You've all worked with Anthony Ainley, haven't you? Tom, you've worked with Anthony Ainley.
So was that a dream?
Yeah.
Well, was it a dream?
What?
How do they explain that?
I've no idea. I've forgotten it by now. I'd even forgotten it by then. It came as a big surprise to me.
Do you remember working with Anthony Ainley, Tom?
No, I don't. I don't remember the plots of the things I was in. It's all, you know, mixed up. The only standout thing I did when I was early on in the thing, at filming, you didn't always have much time to look at the scripts, you know. They were just running about and some close-ups and things like that, but running about in action. And one of the scripts, I had to, with these Neanderthal men or something, and I sort of get a fellow and say, "Take me to your leader, or I'll cut your throat." And I had a dagger. That's what the props gave me. And suddenly I was thinking about this, you know, I said, "I don't want to say that." And the PA came over and said, "Tom, you've got to say it. It's in the script, that's in your contract, you say that." I said, "Well, I'm not saying it. I don't want to say that." So the director called the PA over again, and she logged me. That was a procedure at the BBC. If an actor flatly refused, there was no one high up there to do anything, sack me or what. So they said, "All right." He said, "Okay." So we logged Tom that he refused to say it. And the director, I wonder, was it my beloved David Maloney? He said, "So, all right, we've got to get on with this. Only a few more minutes to get this shot in. What are you going to say?" And I said, I seized this fellow by the nape of his neck and I produced a jelly baby and I said, "Take me to your leader or I'll kill you with this deadly jelly baby." And he said, "Well, go ahead, go on, kill me." And I said, "I don't take orders from anyone." And I bit the head off the jelly baby and said, "Take me to your leader anyway." And he did. So on a Tuesday, at rehearsal, somebody had warned me, you know, that there was going to be trouble there. But what happened is they'd seen the rushes on the Monday. And and they came in. Nobody said a single word. It's a very funny scene, that, Tom. So all the logging was forgotten, you know, and the silliness triumphed. It was a naff line to be using knives. You had to outwit people, didn't you? And here we are. That was why one moment of real script doctoring.
But did any of you have moments where you felt you had to put your foot down or sort of have an opinion that maybe wasn't popular?
Yeah.
I always felt wheedling was a much better way to get in my own way, really. Just by nagging and nagging, isn't it, a little bit? But I was very aware when I took over, because I grew up with Dr. Ting, I understood most of the stories. I found that the directors, generally speaking, didn't know what the hell was going on in the script. Yeah. And it is a process sometimes of papering over the cracks, isn't it, in a script. Oh, if you examine it too closely, virtually any script will fall apart in front of your eyes. And Doctor Who especially, because it's so complicated. In the end, you know, you just do a thin layer of paper over the cracks and then just do it as quickly as you can. People won't notice. Unless, of course, DVDs are invented. And the fans watch the programme over and over again and then think of questions. Why did this happen here?
Yeah, well, I had a problem. It wasn't the scene I was in. It was the scene Sophie was in. It was the Dalek one, the Remembrance of the Daleks. And the Dalek one was also about race. It was to do with race. We were putting it out during the 80s and there were problems in Britain with race relations, and that was kind of our little bit towards helping out, we hoped. And the director, there was a scene where she was in a boarding house, and all, a bay window, and there was a notice. And Ace, Sophie turns the notice around and it says, no colours, no blacks, no Indians, no dogs, or whatever it was. And the director, I happened to be in the rehearsal room at the time, and he said, oh, I think we'll cut that scene. And I went, no, you can't! That's what the whole thing's about! You've got to keep it in! You'd missed it completely because you just said I couldn't believe they missed the story. They missed the whole thing. They just thought it was about Daleks battling each other. They didn't realise it was about something deeper. And I'm pleased to say we did actually keep that scene in. It's there, and it's, you know, it's a kind of a. I'm very pleased that we did. But a lot of times you have to battle for it.
I remember when I did Mind Warp, which is part of the trial season. There was a scene where I had to literally torture Perry, chained to a rock. And having read the script, it seemed to me there were three possibilities. One, and you have to know about this, one, the Matrix was lying, because the scene never happened. It was part of the trial, it was part of the evidence. I, the doctor, did not remember it, but it was shown as part of the evidence. So either it was lying and the Valiard had concocted it, or it did happen, and I was pretending for the benefit of those watching, or the mind warp had deranged me, because I'd just been under the mind warp, which deranged people. So I asked the script editor, he said, I don't know, I'll ask the writer. The writer said, I don't know, the producer told me to put it in. The producer said, I don't know, Eric Saywood did that, he was the script editor. So I made my own decision. None of them would admit to any responsibility for it, so I made my own decision that it was a complete fabrication, that it was invented by the Valiard to incriminate me, and therefore I could go for broke with it.
Quite disturbing, another hero.
Yeah.
Right, now, any second now, we'll be taking questions from the audience, so if you have a question, put your hand up, and one of the nice people in the blue T-shirts will come and ask you. The nasty people in the blue T-shirts won't. And then they'll... you know me so well. And then there will, if they select your question, you'll be taken to one of the four microphones, helpfully numbered 1, 2, 3, and 4. Right, so while that's going on, just one more thing I wanted to mention to you, and it came up there a little bit. John Nathan Turner. You all worked with John Nathan Turner as producer of the show in one way or another. What are your memories of him? He would have loved to have been here, wouldn't he?
He'd have adored it.
I have very fond memories of John. We didn't always agree on anything, but we never had bad words with each other. I just think he was, what he excelled at, John, was getting publicity for the show. I don't think he was a really a science fiction fan at all, and I think that under his tenorship, some producership, some of the decisions were made weren't brilliant at all. But he was doing what he believed was best for the show and to make it as popular as he could possibly do, and he was brilliant at that. But I think his real passion in life, which he never quite managed to do, was to just, he kept telling me, was to start a soap opera. That's really all he really wanted to do, but Doctor Who really wasn't that. So fond memories, but I did disagree with him on quite a few things.
Tom? Well, I didn't get on well with him at all. By that time, of course, I was getting terribly opinionated, about how things should be. I thought he had lamentable taste, and I was amazed at how, when I realised I couldn't go on like this and said, listen, I think I'd better call it a day, he actually embraced me and kissed me passionately. I think he nibbled my yellow. He said, Tom, it's been such fun getting rid of you. But later on in the promotion of Doctor Who and all that sort of stuff, he organised some good stuff. And he was marvellously vulgar, he really liked the popular taste. And he revved up, he kept going. He and his partner, that's how Gary, no one could handle a queue of fans sweeter than Gary Downey. He was just a genius at it. So we became friends later, and I spoke in his funeral. Of course, I speak in a lot of funerals now, because especially people who've worked with me, the word is out, that's why I don't get many jobs now, is that quite a lot of directors, after employing me, have died shortly after. And some of them in terrible agony and very mysterious circumstances. And so, I'm having a pretty quiet life now, apart from working for Big Finish. They're not at all superstitious.
It does.
Yeah.
Luckily, I have. It does worry me. I'm a director too much. Listen, let's take a question. We're very short on time. Microphone one. Hello, what's your name?
Callum.
Hi, Callum. What's your question?
What was your favourite monster when you were doing Doctor Who?
Sylvester. What was your favourite monster?
I liked the first ones I worked with, called the Tet Traps. They're a kind of a mixture of bats and... I don't know what the other bit was, but anyway. But they had three eyes and teeth and things, and the guys that did it were really fit, because they had to be bats, so they had to hang upside down in the studio. So they used to hang these guys upside down, and we'd be acting under them. And when we were acting under them, there would be this drip, drip, drip of sweat on our heads. As these bats were, the bat over there. Oh, there's another one. At least it wasn't bat poo, it was just sweat. But I always thought they looked good. I mean, there was something great about, and when they showed on the screen their view of the world, because they had three eyes, all these three visions. So I liked them, and was sad that they never came back. Yeah, Tet Traps, never mind.
Colin?
I always envied the villains of later years. I wanted to work with a Sleen. A monster that farts. It's got to be the best monster ever. Going around going, oh, it's genius. I've never worked with them. I'd love to have done.
Peter?
I always had a great fondness for Cybermen. Actually, right from the early days when they did, I admit now, I looked for them the other day, it looked ridiculous. They used to have cloth faces and a headlamp on their head. And they took in a strange voice, which would be, we are the Cybermen. We have come to destroy you. But they were revamped for my time, and I rather liked my Cybermen. I'm not sure I like them more than the modern Cybermen, because they could just see, had a perspex lower part of their face, and you could just see the sort of jaw moving. And we had a fantastic head Cyberman, David Banks, who was great in Earthshock. So my favourite would be Cyberman, definitely. Tom?
Well, I think my favourite one, because I had an immortal line, was Destiny of the Daleks. And there was a marvellous close-up with me with two wires, which could end the Daleks.
Oh, Genesis of the Daleks.
What?
Genesis.
Genesis of the Daleks. Yeah. And I was going to put these two wires together and blast them out of existence. But of course, Terry Nation supervised that line. And I had to say, as the wires were coming together, I stopped and said, but have I the right And I had to shake my hand.
He had the right.
Yeah, Telly Nation had the right.
He wanted them alive and screaming.
Yeah, that was great stuff. And well, the Daleks, when we were rehearsing those days, long and regular rehearsals, and the guy, the fellows in the Daleks, you know, used to take the tops off. And so they used to pedal them round and do that with their hands as a plunger. And it was terribly, terribly funny to see the earnestness with which they did it, you know. They really took it very seriously, and I loved that seriousness. And sometimes we'd look in the corner and boys from Zed cars that have crept into our thing, and they were all sniggering, you know. But they all wanted to be in it, you know. They all wanted... I remember Glenda Jackson's son saying, "Mum, can't you get into Doctor Who?" When she was a big, big star.
So, here's a question for you. Do you do when you do it now, the voice of the Daleks? Because you do it on the floor. Because in the old days, I know you did the other day, the William Hartnell thing, yes. 86 thing you did. And in my day, they had two people sat at the table and did the voice actually live.
Yes, yes, I did.
Do you still do that on set,
as much as possible. Yeah,
because when I did it, we had two people in one end of the long studio, and they wouldn't talk to the people who actually operated the Daleks at the other end. They never communicated with each other.
I owe Callum an honest answer to my favourite monster in my family. It was Syl.
Yeah. Thank you.
There you are. The slug, played by Nabil Shaban.
All right.
It's one of greedy slug.
Oh, I remember.
Who was interested in making money.
And you've just done an audio play with him. Syl is coming right. Anyway, I have to wrap this up. I'm so sorry that you didn't get a chance to ask questions.
Doctor Who than David Tennant. I can't say David Tennant though, because every night I have to marry my daughter.
Actually, I'd like to play William Hartnell. I'd like to experience that experience he had when it first started, having no idea. It's going to last 6 weeks. That was it. And then suddenly realizing that he was in something, the best thing he'd ever done in his life. Yeah, I'd like to experience that.
Hey! Thank you.
And then it was a 20-minute break with us sat in our seats. I think you fell asleep. And then we had the 11th hour talk with Matt Smith, Jenna Coleman, Stephen Moffat, and the other chap that I can't remember the name of who didn't really answer. The producer bloke who didn't really answer any questions. But the good thing about that particular talk was that Stephen Moffat was on amazing form and rather went up in my estimation.
Hi, but you're having a fantastic time. Fantastic event. I've been out mingling and having a look and spending a fortune on all the merchandise because I brought my kids with me. I'm sure a lot of you have done exactly the same, yeah? Everyone bought the sonic screwdrivers, expensive bits of memorabilia, the odd fares, yeah? It's not just me, is it? Anyway, what we're doing here today is getting the insight into the Doctor Who. We're here for the 50th celebration, of course, and we've got some of the people who are right on the front line who are going to be sitting on these red settees with me now. So, let me do the introductions. Firstly, a man who's produced Doctor Who for the last 2 years, including the episode we're going to watch tonight. Please welcome Marcus Wilson. Show's lead writer and executive producer. Please welcome Stephen Moffat. Yeah. role of Doctor's companion to a new level, playing Clara Oswald, who's recently been revealed as the girl who saved the Doctor in all his incarnations. Please welcome Gemma Coleman. All on a grand tour of the universe for the past 4 fabulous years. Please welcome the 11th Doctor himself, Mr. Matt Smith! From all different eras here today and over the weekend. So I'm intrigued to know who've been 4 doctors. So let's start off with Marcus first of all.
Tom Baker, I think, is my first doctor, but I always think of Matt as my doctor.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
How very diplomatic. Yeah. How very diplomatic. And what was it that you remember from Tom's performance as the doctor?
I just remember the kind of madness of it. He was such an eccentric alien character, there was nothing like him on television. So it just made a huge impression.
And Stephen, for you? Apart from Matt.
Oh, but I can't choose. I'm a proper Doctor Who fan. I like them all more than each other. Why have one hero when you can have 11?
And Jenna, Doctor Who for you. Was there a Doctor who stood out that you remember?
This is my Doctor.
This is your Doctor. And Matt?
Well, it sort of wasn't on the telly for me. So, you know, the first Doctor that I engaged with, really, was Chris and David. But then I went back, who I love, I went back subsequently. You know, for me it's like Chris and David and Patrick Troughton. I love Patrick. But Patrick, I just think, also, Patrick Troughton has the most ridiculous run that I've ever seen, which is amazing. I mean, there's a great clip in the Name of the Doctor, and he's running in his fur coat, and it's the most sort of brilliant mad run.
A really lovely lady, so I've got to meet quite a few people walking around, and a lady came up to me and she said, can you please ask, and I'm going to do this because it's a good question, in the wardrobe, the Doctor's wardrobe, so obviously 11 different costumes, so this is for Matt only, I'm afraid. If you were going to wear another Doctor's costume, ooh, what would you choose from the wardrobe? Ooh. Which outfit do you really covet the most?
Do you know what?
Take a look at them, yeah.
It would probably be one of Troughton or Hartnell for me, I think. But then Pertwee's jacket. Pertwee's other colour though. I prefer the purpley.
The burgundy kind of colour.
It would be Troughton or Pertwee in purple, I think.
Yeah. And you brought, I think, elements of both their wardrobes to your own wardrobe. So.
Yeah, and I'm pleased I got the purple in there. I was like, I like the colour purple.
Steve, we're going to go back a few years, and am I right in thinking that you were originally looking for a slightly older Doctor when you were casting, and you ended up with the youngest Doctor, Matt?
Yes, in fact, I still got my angry emails, because I'd seen the list they sent, and they said that no 27-year-old is ever going to be able to play this part, I said, with the wisdom of a showrunner who hadn't produced a single show. And it was, and of course I didn't cast a 27-year-old, I cast a 26-year-old, but it was...
Was this pre the audition?
Oh, yes, pre the audition. Oh, yeah.
What, because Andy Pryor thought, I'll get Matt in, maybe.
No. I didn't know that your name had yet appeared on the list. It was just I was saying, can't we have some older people?
Yeah.
I mean, I thought he's going to have to flirt with River Song, he's going to have to be all these things, and he's got to be a dangerous stranger from outer space.
Yeah.
And there are no young boys who can play that part.
Do you know, generally speaking, I'm right. Generally speaking, that's absolutely spot on.
You're always right.
Because the other younger ones... It doesn't work for them. With Matt, who somehow manages to create an old Doctor in those eyes and in those mannerisms and in that mad old boffin that he suddenly became, it just worked. And of course, the moment you see a young man without affectation playing an old man, it's arresting, it's extraordinary. You can't take your eyes off it.
When did Matt first come into your consciousness?
When he came in, the very first person we ever auditioned for the role of Dr. Watson in Sherlock. He was the very first person through the door. And we did. We all thought he was terrific. I remember Kate Rhodes James, who's the casting director on Sherlock, said he's so compelling, that boy. But the fact is, what I said at the time was, he's more Sherlock Holmes than Dr. Watson, and we already had a Sherlock Holmes. So I didn't think he was right for us at all, but he was a very, very good addition. A couple of days later, I saw him for Doctor Who, and we more or less, he really was decided on the spot, but we had to go through the process. I presume, Matt, you just thought I ran every television series in the world.
Yeah, pretty much. It was such a like, strange thing. Like, and actually, with Jenna's first audition, me and Stephen, after, like, it was like a day after her first audition, and we went to our friend's party, Piers, who used to produce the show, and Jenna came with her boyfriend randomly and bumped into me and Stephen, and poor Jenna was like, oh God.
Oh,
they're everywhere. It's funny how the world works.
What was your first audition like? What do you remember? The audition
I remember
process?
Everything. There was a goldfish in the corner. I wore a tweed blazer. It was in this really weird carpeted room. I did the scene from The 11th Hour, which I read, and was just like, wow, what? Because I hadn't seen much Doctor Who, because it wasn't on the telly, really, when I was a kid, and I didn't engage with it much. So I read The 11th Hour, and was like, oh my God, this is spellbindingly good.
So before then, you weren't desperate to get the role?
Well, it just wasn't in my consciousness, and then my mum, I texted me, and said, you should be, because I had a scarf that I used to wear at uni, which was like a sort of Tom Bakery scarf. And yeah, it wasn't as long, but it was like pattern and stuff. Not just because I thought it was cool, not because I thought it was like Tom Baker, which turns out is cool. and she said, you should be the next Doctor Who. And then the next day, literally, I got a call from my agent saying, do you want to go and audition for Doctor Who? I was like, well, why not?
It's so interesting that you didn't have the yearning and the obsession that so many other people have. And yet you were so right for that role.
Yeah, and in a way, I think maybe, hopefully, that sort of worked in my favour, because I just sort of treated it like any other audition. And now I'm like, now if I auditioned for it, I'd be like, oh, God.
So Matt, that's you making your debut, and we saw all the old Doctors were flashing there, the history of the Doctor Who story, and now you're part of that Doctor Who story, you're one of the old Doctors,
yeah.
So you know, you will be one of those old men.
Yeah,
was it difficult to leave Doctor Who? Tough
really,
decision.
Really difficult.
So tell us your thinking.
Well, I don't know, I don't know what I was thinking, to be honest with you. I'm an idiot. You know, I wanted to go out on a high, and it was the 50th year, and I'd had such a great time, and I've been really lucky to work with two wonderful companions. The lead writer's all right, you know, Marcus, and a wonderful producer, and I don't know, I sort of wanted to go out while I was still on top, I suppose, and I don't know, really.
Had you given yourself a set time that you were going to work as the Doctor? Did you know that it was... You weren't going to be doing it for 10 years?
I don't think anyone nowadays could do it for 10 years because it's such a demanding role. No, I hadn't set any time on it really, but you just take it year by year. But I'll never forget it. It's the best job I'd ever had. And probably, you know, look at this.
It's an incredible phenomenon. It's a family to be part of, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an amazing family to be part of. Woo! Yeah. It really is. I think there's a sense of fandom and sort of ownership in Doctor Who, where we all, I don't know, we're a unique bunch, I think. We stick together.
You have to be a special sort of person to be Doctor Who.
Yeah.
I think that's what we're saying.
Yeah.
And would you ever come back when, you know,
yeah.
5 years down the line and you're invited to do some sort of...
I would leap back in a heartbeat, but, you know...
So would you have him back?
Yes, well, absolutely. I've told him that, first of all, that... It is absolutely obligatory that when you are asked that for an anniversary, you damn well say yes.
Yes.
Otherwise, you are letting people go. And also, you have to go and do some stories for Big Finish, who do the audio adventures. So you can do those, mate.
Yeah,
it's you're not going away from there. You can trust them, they'll be good.
It's always going to be in your life. Jenna, can you tell us about your role as Clara and how you know, what Stephen told you about the story, about your role, because it's such a pivotal role to be playing. Did you realise it was going to be that big when you first took it on?
No, I had no idea about the history. I had no idea what was going to happen in the name of the Doctor at all when I took on the part. I knew there was a character called Oswin, futuristic space chick, hanging out inside a broken Dalek, who was a Dalek. I knew there was going to be Victorian Clara and modern-day Clara, but I had no idea why, so I just treated kind of each incarnation completely independently until I picked up the name of the Doctor script. And then blew my mind. Yeah.
Wow. And of all the companions, because there have been many memorable, there are people, again, like they have their favourite doctors, they have their favourite companion. Are there people who've inspired you? Because you will have gone back and you will have met them here this weekend, I guess, some of the companions. Are there people that you've been inspired by?
It's interesting because when I first got the part, one of the big things for me was I watched The 11th Hour, which I loved, and then I decided not to watch anything else, because I think the part of the companion is you're coming into something that you don't know, and everything is about experiencing it for the first time and kind of embracing it and going on a spaceship. You've never seen a Dalek, you've never seen this world before. So for me, it was kind of a leap of faith and really brave, and as a person kind of run alongside with that at the same time.
And what was important for you to make Clara into, you know, the key thing of her personality and what she was like?
I mean, I had no idea, and I think it's the kind of thing that the show goes so fast as soon as you jump on board, but I think ultimately it's what kind of person. If somebody turned up on your doorstep who was an alien with two hearts and had a police box and said, come inside and let's travel through all the time and space together, what kind of person would say, all right?
The whole of this room.
Just me. Oh, not just me, surely. I really did cry when I watched that. Brilliant, yeah. What a sap, eh? Yeah. That, I think, is it right that was the first time the Doctor got married? Stephen?
Well, no, because he starts the show with the Grand Doctor, doesn't he?
Of course.
He married Marilyn Monroe during A Christmas Carol. This man marries about a bit, let me tell you. And don't assume he's stopped.
So tell us about Riversong and her story. Have we seen the end of Riversong's story? Is she...
Well, I mean, we've sort of covered everything you need to know. When I first introduced her in Science in the Library 128 years ago, I had no idea if we'd do that again. I thought she might be the 45th Doctor's wife on that. But then she, Alex was so good, it just and everyone wanted to see her again, so we just brought her back. I've always thought there should be stuff, God knows, that goes on between the Doctor and River that we never know about, and certainly don't see. I don't want to know of such things. I used to be terrified of the idea I'd ever have a scene with the Doctor and River on their own. Because I thought, what's going to stop her then? I've got to get something in the way.
There's a lot of passion there.
And I ended up having to do one of those Minnesota things we did for the DVDs. And the only two people we had available to play for that were Matt and Alex. So I had to introduce three different versions of Riversong to keep interrupting her before she got too naughty. So there are moments we have not seen between the Doctor and River. And that's the way it should be. The Doctor is a gentleman of the universe and certainly does not tell. So we don't know. We don't quite know what really goes on between the two of them.
I guess it brings to mind Time Traveller's Wife. Is that something that you're...
Yeah, about? Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. You know, I love that book.
And that was a very quick answer that you just gave me there. You threw me completely.
Well, do you want me a longer answer? I can give you a longer answer if you like.
Give me a longer answer if you want to. But you don't have to give me a long one at all. Marcus is producer of the show tonight. What do we have to look forward to? Just give us a tantalising glimpse of what we can expect.
I think it'll be a roller coaster ride. It's, you know, Stephen's fantastic script gives you kind of, there are sort of kisses to the past and also big changes to the story of the Doctor. So it's one of those key episodes that, you know, you hopefully watch it and just go, wow.
Okay, Stephen, would you like to elaborate a little bit more? Are there any hints or clues that you can give us?
You kidding? No.
Jenna, would you like to give any clues?
God, I don't know. I'm getting too scared now. It's really, really close.
Yeah, I'm starting to feel a bit.
I'm really, really anxious and nervous. Properly nervous. Yeah, I'm breaking it. Let's be
And will you all be watching this together?
Yeah.
Going through the experience together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're probably in a whimpering huddle.
Just screaming to kill it.
Yeah.
And the whole world will be watching it as well with
you. Well, bring that on!
No pressure whatsoever. No. And Twitter will be alive with feedback straight away.
You having fun or what?
I'm loving this. Yeah. What was it like working with John Hurt, Matt?
Cool. He's a rock star. Yeah. He's like kind of me and David are like there climbing the furniture. John just flicks his eyes and the camera goes, oh, let's look at John. he's amazing. He's an amazing actor and a rocking dude.
Yeah.
And really like Johnny Hurt. And David was fab and Billy and I don't know, I think it's really nice for me and Jenna being part of the show now, because these are really historic times for Doctor Who. And it's cool that we get to be part of its sort of ongoing history in such a big way.
Stephen, your idea to get John Hurt on board, I presume?
Yes, well, the idea was, you know, what story are we going to tell for the 50th? What are we going to do? And as a Doctor Who fan, I felt every miserable day of that 60-year gap. Curse you, Michael Gray. I like it. I like that a television executive can make a decision so bad, people are cheering when he's produced 16 years later. That's when you know you got it wrong. Okay, I missed that sort of bit. But also it meant that there were 16 years when the Doctor was up to something, we don't know what it was. Now this is a man who doesn't tell you who he's married to, or even how many people he's married to, doesn't tell you his name. This is a man who keeps secrets, so what was he up to? And the moment I thought, and I remember thinking, well, what if there's a whole other Doctor he hasn't mentioned? I thought, wow, that is just exciting. That is just naughty. Are we allowed to do that? I checked the rule book, nothing against it at all.
You
are ruled by Stephen Moffat. That's fine.
And the idea, the notion of the War Doctor.
Well, the War Doctor, well, yes, it was an exciting idea. I didn't call them that initially because I was too frightened. But of it getting out, but I thought if there is another Doctor, it has to be somebody epic. You have to gasp when he turns around. We can't just cast anybody in that part. You know, there are many fine actors, you know, who wouldn't cause people to fall off their chairs when they turn around. And if you cast a brilliant, wonderful, famous actor like that, not that he would say yes to such a thing, Brad Pitt, it wouldn't work. People go, oh, I love Brad Pitt, but he's not the bloody Doctor, is he? You had to cast somebody that people would always have wanted to be the Doctor, but you know is never going to be, it's never going to happen now. It's like the treat you've been denied, you get after all. So the idea that John Hurt turns around, and we, like the tarts we are, go, introducing John Hurt as the Doctor, look what we did! Way! We're going to make a special caption!
Did you phone him? Email John Hurt? How did you
persuade
him to do it? Tell us that.
With proper trepidation, with nervousness, we're sort of slightly freaked out. Yeah. Sending a script to John Hurt for Doctor Who, what's he going to say? He said yes within a few hours, is what he said. And that's the first person we sent it to, the first person we discussed it. Our absolute ideal choice was John. And what we hoped in our hearts was somebody would think, hang on, so you say, I can get to be the Doctor officially and properly with action figure, but I only have to play it once. And you're thinking, okay. That is exactly what John Hurt thought. Hang on, that's a good offer. I'm officially the Doctor.
And how did you feel working with him and watching him realise your ideas? Was he everything you dreamt to be, or...?
As all the truly great ones are, just very sweet, very kind, very polite, but you are slightly aware he's John Hurt and he knows your name. And you go, wow, that's amazing. He recognises his name when I walk past. That's fantastic. And that voice.
Voice. And as all the great ones are, it's like, it's just that thing where he does sort of 80% less than you, but fills every thought with like 80% more than you.
He just has to move a muscle here, doesn't he?
And there's so much. He just
you know, he just knows how to do it immediately and instinctually. He's just really a brilliant actor. He was amazing to watch, wasn't he?
It was amazing to watch, and also in between scenes, we'd kind of all huddle in the corner and just like listen to his stories.
He was quite a party doctor.
Oh, my
party,
God.
He's got some real.
So you hang out with a lot of rock stars, John Hurt.
They don't make him like John Hurt.
Would he ever come back, John Hurt?
John Hurt, the John Hurt. He's gone native. The way he was even promoting the show on the lunch show the other day, bloody hell.
Yeah,
you've gone for it, haven't you?
He really likes it, I think he's coming tonight.
Yeah.
He's coming tonight to watch it again.
He's going to come watch it with us and stuff.
It's going to be a good after-show party.
Yes.
I would love to see you about 12 o'clock tonight, along with you.
With John.
We're
here again at 10 o'clock.
We'll see you at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Tomorrow is going to be a very, very quiet town.
Yeah. You've got to be in a good state of mind.
Everybody just keep it down.
Tell us a little bit about the clip that went online with Paul McGann that you...
I know that I can be irritating sometimes. But am I not right that it is better that we keep secrets? Is that not right? No. The reason I'm asking this question is I want to hear that reaction, because some people in here will be bloggers, some people in here will be journalists. I believe the audience wants us to keep secrets and to surprise you and to give you that thrill now and then. That's why we sometimes, or even always, lie. It's not because we're evil, it's we just want to give you a treat. Mm. Now, even if, there were blogs online already, I regret to say, putting up photographs of Paul McGann and giving it away. And that's why we brought it forward and why we rushed it out and said, get to your televisions or your iPlayers, I'm so modern, in and out, get there and watch it and get the thrill. Because people were already showing off that they knew. There's not news. It's fiction, it's not news. You shouldn't be blurting out lovely secrets like that. So, please, tell everybody who's inclined to spoil your stories for you that you would like them to shut. Someone's on a guy on a website in this room going,
We have the Christmas episode to look forward to, and then you start filming again in March with a whole new series.
January.
Do we see it in March?
What?
When do we see the next series?
It'll be the second half of the year, he said, deliberately vaguely, because he doesn't know.
Okay. I'm just naively asking. Are there monsters that you haven't, or foes, enemies of the Doctor that you have at the back of your mind that you can hint at here, or is everything just...
For the new run, you mean?
Yeah, the new run.
I can't discuss it in front of Matt, he gets crossed. You understand, you are going to come back at some point and fight all the new ones, I promise, okay? Oh. You know you're going to. It's all right. Yes, we've got lots of great, exciting, scary new monsters, don't worry.
Are there any that haven't been brought back that you've always kind of had at the back of your mind? There must be, like...
I think... I've never had the trouble to tell the truth, do I? Reading the back catalogue, it hasn't finished. But I think at the beginning when Doctor first came back, we brought back Daleks, or Russell brought back Daleks and Cybermen and Talons and all that, in order to sort of prove it was Doctor Who. It was like grabbing the icons and saying, look, this show is Doctor Who. Now we just raid it for brilliant ideas, and let me tell you, those original 26 years is full of brilliant ideas, one or two of which we now have the technical facility to realise better than they could. So we can finesse their genius. I do spend a lot of time on Modern Doctor Who finessing the genius of the old show, but it's the genius that counts, not the finesse.
How do you navigate between making it appealing to kids? Look, we've got these kids down here at the front, and then also making it sufficiently complex to hook in all the adults as well, and then a little bit
complex
scary.
For the adults, they can't understand a bloody thing. Trust me.
You must want to sometimes get really carried away and go incredibly dark and scary and very complicated, and then you have to
bring
it back.
Do you know what I do?
And you do, yeah.
You're all terrible. Do you think Doctor Who should be scary? Kids only. Should Doctor Who be scary?
Yes!
Do you think it's better, kids in the audience, do you think it's better when Doctor Who is scary?
Yes!
Yes! Yes! Yeah,
yeah. You seem a little bit slow on the upkick tape while watching an episode of Doctor Who. Do they? Kids?
They're scared, but you scared them to death. Tell you what, we're going to do. We're going to ask
Tell
questions.
Me later.
Well,
you know what it means when you've seen on a big screen.
Hey,
right.
Oh,
not the runaways. Oh, no. Oh,
come back.
We won't look at you again. It's all right.
We won't pick
I
know
what you feel, but I can see myself all the time, and I am so badly in need of a haircut. Thank you.
You will have questions, I'm sure, in the audience now. What you have to do is put your hand up, and someone in a blue shirt will come and they'll chat to you. We'll try and get as many questions as we can, and we'll ask all the people who sat here on the red sofa. So just be patient, and someone will come and speak to you. How long can Doctor Who carry on for? Matt, what do you reckon? I mean, 50 years down the line, will they still be doing this kind of thing?
I don't see why it should stop. I think, you know, kind of Stephen often talks about the format of the show being really clever, and I think ultimately it is. So therefore, why should it stop? Why? And you know, and it can keep appealing to generations and generations. Like, all the kids here now will tell their sons and daughters about it. I'll tell my son about it and my daughter. I'll go, hey, look, it was me.
It's also nice how many families it brings. You know, there's so many people that watch it as a family, and it's something that, you know, people can share together on a Saturday night. And people coming here as a family and having photos taken as a family together as well. So I think, you know, you're never going to run out of places to go in all of space and time.
And it's not just people singing, you know, it's not just like there's an actual narrative to it, which I think is nice. There's a family show that still does that, you know.
Is that a dis X Factor?
No, I love X Factor. Okay. Don't get me wrong. But that does what it does, and it, I think, kind of Doctor Who offers something different.
Let's go to the first question. So we have someone just over there. If you want to ask a question, tell us who you are, first of all. Hi, over there.
Hi, I'm Giuditta from Italy.
Yay! You came from Italy to be here today?
Yeah.
Wow, well done. Who's your question for?
My question is for Stephen. How did you become a Doctor Who writer?
By sort of asking, really. I mean, I became a Doctor Who writer by, first of all, becoming a television writer. And I had quite a good career going by the time Doctor Who came back. I was doing quite well. When I heard it was coming back, of course, he was immediately disappointed it wasn't me that was bringing it back. But I was delighted that it was Russell, because he was actually the best possible choice, including me, the absolute right man to bring it back. But I did immediately email him, because I knew him, and congratulate him. I didn't do anything as egregious as ask him for a job. But I did make sure he had my current email address. And he emailed straight back saying, if it goes to more than six, I'd love you to do so. More than six. And then I was over the moon at that. But if the general question is how to become a Doctor Who writer, become a writer first. Doctor Who is not a beginner show, really, in any capacity. It's not a show for beginners. Become a writer first, write your own stories, get really good at it, and then one day write a Doctor Who story and discover, as I did, that you've learned nothing at all.
But how great is it looking out at the audience here, the number of fezzes that you can see?
I was just saying, I love everyone's commitment to the fez. Keep the fez going when I'm gone, guys. Because I love everyone in fezzes, it's so cool.
They're as far as the eye can see.
Yeah, it makes me really happy.
When I'm gone, we're not actually killing you, Matt. Most of the theatre, it's not the same thing as death.
Have any of you ever gone to any fancy dress parties and stolen anything from the Doctor Who props cupboard or any of the costume departments?
Yeah.
Stephen, have you ever gone to a Doctor Who, have you ever dressed up as anything?
I have.
Well,
I have two Silurian guns in my house.
And I don't know how to take them back now because I've had them there for a very long while. And you can't really casually walk into the prop store and say, just put that back. I'll have it too.
Best keep. Another question there. Hi, who are you?
Hi.
Where are you? Sorry.
Where?
All right, tell us your question.
Mac. That means Mac's
place. Hey, where are you? I can't
tell. I'm right here.
Hello.
There's no light on you. I'm really sorry. It's just got the guy who's dressed as Peter Davison for. Or is it Sylvester McCoy?
We can see you now. We can see you.
Go on, tell us your question. Tell us.
Hey, Mac.
Yeah.
I love you.
Oh, right back at you, dude.
Thanks.
What's your name again? Tell us your name again.
Charles Louis Kennedy, but you can just call me Charles.
All right, Charles. Good to meet you, Charles.
Thanks.
Would you like to be the doctor one day, Charles?
If I could do it with Matt Smith or David Tennant, yeah. Or be a Dalek.
You'd like to be a Dalek?
One day.
Well, yeah.
Is that the best enemy or monster that you like?
I love Daleks, duh! You always get right in my face.
Right, is that it? That's your question?
Well, my sister's got a question.
Go on, ask us a question. What's your sister called?
Faith.
Hi,
hello.
Faith.
What's your question?
Which TARDIS do you like the best?
Which TARDIS do I like the best? Ooh, that's a tough one, isn't it? Crikey. Well, I'm lucky that I've had two, and I have different... I like one of mine the best, obviously. So between the two, I like them both for different reasons. I liked my old one because to fly, there was quite nice... This sounds really silly, but there's quite nice rhythms. It has quite a sort of nice rhythmic feel to it. And the new one's got a spinny thing, which I quite like too. And I like David's TARDIS as well. But I'd say probably my first one, just because it was just my first one. Like your first kiss.
Aww. Thank you for your question.
It was about
under an underpass. Yeah.
This was in Northampton, right?
In Northampton.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, the Northampton must have been
it. Yes! Right on.
Next question then, please. Hi, who are you?
Betsy.
Hey, Betsy. What's your question? Who's it to?
Matt. What is your favourite monster in Doctor Who?
My favourite monster in Doctor Who is the Weeping Angel.
Oh, what's your favourite angel?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, it's cool, isn't it? That's my fave.
Okay, thank you very much, Betsy. And your question?
Hello.
Hello.
What's the funniest moment that's ever happened to you in Doctor Who?
Jenna.
Oh. You told me a funny one before. With Lily Cole on set.
Oh, yeah.
Something fell on your head or you fell over? Matt falls over on a pretty much a daily basis. He did quite a great, amazing fall in the Rings of Akaton. You were trying to do the skin on the sand.
Oh,
the
really
skin went terribly wrong.
Yeah, that was bad, wasn't it?
That was actually quite bad.
Don't worry, I fell over a lot too.
There you go. We share a similar affliction.
Yes. You look great as well. What's your name? I didn't ask your name, sorry.
James,
thank you.
I think we both fell off the bike as well, didn't we, in Bells of St. John, motorbike.
Oh yeah, got it, really heavy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
We didn't get harmed, we were fine.
Yeah, that's what's great about sort of Who is there's so many fun. It's such a great show to make. It's really fun.
Is it physically quite grueling?
Gosh.
Okay, tell us about your injuries. What have you done?
I mean the list is too long. But, it's such a demanding thing because it takes such energy. You know, you're constantly sort of running and stopping and sliding around and you're doing it take after take after take and you have to sort of throw yourself into it. It's good fun though.
Tell us who you based how you found your doctor. Who were the people that inspired you, and you kind of put them all into a melting pot and then became a doctor.
Watched the things I watched, which I would recommend anyone watch, are all the Pink Panthers with Inspector Clouseau, with Peter Sellers, and then there was a sitcom called Some Mothers Do Albert with an actor called Michael Crawford,
I watched Remember
Frank Spencer?
Frank Spencer. Oh, Betty. And that's a terrible impression. And then I read a lot about Albert Einstein. Yeah, which again, I would recommend kids read about Albert Einstein. He was cool.
Tell us, how was he cool? What's it?
Einstein?
Yeah, on the opposite side. Just great.
Yeah, well, and just his view of the world is sort of mad and irreverent and brilliant and of the cosmos. He's a big believer in, you know, fellow atheist as well. And he's just a cool dude. And he stuck his tongue out and I just liked him. I thought, yeah, you'd be my chum.
You've got Madeline for my doctor. Another question then. Hi, what's your name?
Hi, I'm Robin. Just want to say I'm a science teacher and I spend every day convincing everyone I'm science school.
Einstein is cool. I back you up there, Rob.
Thank you.
So,
watching the series, and particularly going back to some of your earlier adventures, it seems like you play it quite differently if you watch it. You've kind of grown in the role and it seems very different to what it was at the beginning. So I guess this is to you and to Stephen. How has it changed for you from those first episodes to what you're writing now for Matt? And how is it for you playing it now, Matt?
Thanks, Ron. I started not knowing who's going to play the part. I wrote three scripts before I knew who was going to play the part. And then Matt came in and everybody immediately said how brilliantly I'd rewritten the scripts from that. I hadn't touched them. Everyone was just picturing Matt in their own. What really happens, though, I don't know how aware Matt is of this, is you just start following the actor. You start noticing, oh, that works, or he's pushing it that way. And you just, I tried to write Matt's Doctor. I tried to keep up with him. That's the truth. That's the way it works. And one thing we did say at the very beginning, both of us, we don't mind if the new Doctor takes a while to form, because a minute ago he's David Tennant, and now he's got a new body, and he's going to take a while to settle into that. So it was quite purposeful. I felt as though he sort of arrived somewhere in that Silurian episode, that scene with Alea in the crypt. I felt the new Doctor was there, really there.
Interesting, yeah. I think Stephen always writes really well for me comically. I think he sort of gets me and gets me physically as well. And also he just takes the piss out of me all the time, to be honest with you. Which sort of works. The amount of chin jokes or jokes about oncoming grey hair or about me looking older, which are generally funny. And then I think he sort of appealed to the darker side of the character, you know, to my taste as well, and I was quite intrigued by that and by the blood on his hands. Because if you consider the blood on his hands, there's so much. Think of all the great time war, the people that he's lost, the people that he's... And I always wanted to keep evolving, and the costume as well. It's quite a conscious thing that I wanted to go every year. He should feel like a slightly different character.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Terribly sorry, but we're going to have to wrap it up there, so I apologise if people are waiting to ask their questions.
Can I just because our young man... Can we get a microphone to this young man here, please? Just quick, or come up here with me. This is our young man that we embarrassed. So we can have a hand there. Why do you like presents so much?
It's weird, isn't it?
What, do you not like presents? But presents are cool, man. Because they're cool. Look at them. What's not cool about a fez?
Yeah, just look at these people here.
Listen, I am... What's your name?
Oliver.
So what's a cool hat, do you think?
No, just hats generally are like... This is where we disagree on that. I think, for me, the fez is a rocking. Anyway, thanks for your question.
Ancient person, and you're reflecting back on your life one by one. What has Doctor Who meant to you? The involvement that you've had, the part it's played in your life, in just a sentence, maybe two. Marcus.
Best job I've ever had. Privilege to be here.
And Stephen.
Best job I've ever had. I mean, that's it. I can't better that. Best job, best TV show.
A unique, wonderful moment in time and something I'll never, ever forget.
Matt, what has it meant to you? Because this is an emotional time. This is like your swan song being here. Just to reflect on what it's meant to you.
It's like best job.
Thank you very much. Best job, best fans, best chicks, best friends, best adventures. And, you know, I got to play the big man and I'll never forget it, you know. So, thank you.
After that, we had to. What did we have to do after the thingy? I think we went around to try and see if we could find something to eat again.
No, we went to the shop.
Oh, yes, we went to the shop, which was all. You had to queue to go into the merchandise shop. Apart from when you wanted the DW celebration merchandise, so which I'd already pre booked my t shirt. We went to the shops and bought a few goodies. What did I get? Oh, yeah, the Tom Baker time capsule box set, which was only 67 quid there, which I seemed to. 57 quid, sorry. It is. Yes, it is. But normal price of that, I think, was about 100 quid. So that was a bit of a bargain. And then we went around all the other little shops like Forbidden Planet. Ian McNeice was there, but he was charging £15 for an on-the-spot photograph or autograph, and we'd already spent our quota on Colin Baker on that one. And then we got some T-shirts from Forbidden Planet. We did get some other goodies from the merchandise shop in a goodie bag, didn't we? Some wristbands and things like that. And badges and things, didn't we? What did you get? You got a sonic screwdriver, didn't you? Which you seem to be playing with at the moment. And you've shut up now because you're sulking because I told you to sit up. So, yeah, that was a bit of a kerfuffle. Very, very busy. But I think I jumped the queue, actually, to buy those T-shirts at Forbidden Planet. The Big Finish store had people signing autographs of the stuff they've written for, I think, or they were starring in. So basically had everything Doctor Who there, some lovely stuff, which was all very expensive. The one I really, really wanted, there was a store doing Matt Smith jackets, but they were well over £100. They had the Dickie Bows as well, but again, we'd already spent all the money and there was no way. No, we'd already bought the T-shirts by then.
But it didn't matter, though.
Yeah, but there's no point having the dicky bow without the jacket. But that would have been about £150-£200. So, but I would have liked to have had one of those jackets, I must admit, but not for that price. I mean, they are probably worth it, but I haven't never got. Will you stop doing that? Never got £200. Say Alicia could have got that. She's got loads of money. If she'd come with us, she could have bought that for me to make up for not buying me anything for my birthday or anything for last Christmas, you know. But she probably wouldn't have done. Can you sit up, please? So after we sort of rushed around the shops, then we went around the... Oh, we did take some pictures, didn't we?
Yeah.
With the various objects. You had your picture taken with what? Some things, didn't you?
Yeah.
Dinosaur biting your arm off. A Dalek. We had that Union Jack Dalek in the merchandise shop. We had our picture taken with that. We had the TARDIS console, didn't we? It's lovely, Deb. We went into the TARDIS console. And I had our picture taken with Matt Smith's TARDIS. That was really good. And then we had a bit of time to try and find something to eat. But you're very fussy and not feeling very well. So basically, all we could get was an extremely expensive hot dog for £5.50, or was it £6.50? Yeah, with very dry bread. And then we had to start queuing for the showing then, the screening. The time did go. So then we went to the screening. We met Henry about six or seven times. That's a chap who provided us with the ticket for Colin Baker. And I forgot to mention that just as we arrived at the beginning of the day, actually, forgot to mention, in the queue was Rick Stevens, who tweeted me, "I'm right behind you," and there he was with his family, so it's nice to see him. We did bump into him a few times during the day, and I also forgot to mention that the second time we went into the main arena, we bumped into the people from some Doctor Who podcast, who agreed to speak for a very brief period of time. The screening. So magical to be able to watch such a brilliant show with a load of Doctor Who fans. The atmosphere was amazing. The show was fantastic. And then, of course, we had trouble trying to get back to the blooming hotel. Absolute nightmare. Couldn't get around. The sat-nav was sending us around in circles. And then the other sat-nav was also trying to send us around in circles. So, but I deliberately took a wrong turning, and we seemed to get away from the XL and off to the M25. And then they'd blocked off a road, and the sat-nav could not work out that I couldn't go down the same road over and over again. So, again, I took a wrong turning, and eventually, very luckily, ended up at the Dartford Travelodge.
Thanks to
Isabella, who, as I went down the a dead end, came back down the dead end, reversed down it, and there was a Burger King. Well, I was going to get out the car and ask the Burger King where the Travelodge was.
And who saved the day?
Isabella saw the sign for Travelodge, and there we were. And we didn't get home until about, what was it, about 10:30, 11?
Midnight.
Because we bought the Burger King about 10:45, just before they shut. And that was the only real proper food, or if you can call that proper food, we'd had all day. But, you know, in hindsight, the day was an absolutely amazing day. And I know people like Dave Simon bought tickets for 2 days, and I think that probably, if you could afford it, would have been a better option, because it was such a big event. Certainly, for an individual, probably too big for 1 day. If you really want to enjoy it, or wanted to enjoy it, if they do it again in 10 years' time, I think I would be attempting to get tickets for 2 days. Don't you think, Deb? Yeah. I hope they do it in 10 years' time, if I'm still fit enough in 10 years' time to do a Doctor Who thing like that. What it has made me decide, Isabella, that I'd like to do another Doctor Who convention, you know, a standard one. I'd like to go to one and one day and enjoy it that way, a fan-run one. But, yes, I suppose that's probably about it. We did get an email, but that can be on the next show. So thank you for listening to the 20 Megabyte Doctor Who podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. And see you in a couple of days' time. Bye.
Doctor Who Podcast is an APV Services production and is a proud member of the Doctor Who Podcast Alliance. Doctor Who is a trademark of the BBC. No copyright infringement intended.